I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You can sober up and still be funny and crazy. In a nutshell, that's Augustine Burroughs' philosophy in his new book, Dry. The guy had plenty of reasons to be a drunk. Just check out his childhood in his first book, Running with Scissors. Now, the abandoned, abused kid is a top ad man by day, two bottles of scotch and more than a few martinis lush by night. When his boss delivers the ultimatum, get dried out or get out, Augustine begins his journey down the road to sobriety. Through detox, AA, and a near-death relapse, he finds a second salvation. The moral of the tale is, no matter how much of a mess you are, you can always reinvent yourself. Connection listeners, can we kick our habits by reinventing ourselves? Or are we just running away from the truth? And can too much humor be an obstacle for a healthy recovery? Our number is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALKS. Augustine Burroughs is our guest this hour. He joins us from our NPR studios in New York. Augustine Burroughs, great read. Let's start where you start. Your double life. You're this successful ad man in advertising and going home to a completely different life. Just give us a taste.
Well, by day, you know, I was sitting there in my little, you know, swanky suit in a, you know, commercial, in a meeting for, you know, whether a perfume or a credit card. And then I'd go home and I lived in complete squalor. I mean, that's the weird part of my life. I was really doing, you know, well when you looked at me. You know, I appeared to be put together as long as you didn't get too close and smell my breath. But I appeared to be a normal together, you know, 28-year-old, 20 guy. And I lived in complete chaos. I mean, you know, I never took the bottles out when I was drinking. So there were hundreds of bottles or cans, if it were beer, and food containers. And I thought about it later, and I think it's because I was, like, replicating my chaotic childhood. So I thought, you know, chaos is the one thing that I know. So I just sort of replicated it when I was an adult.
Incredible squalor and also incredible drinking bouts. I mean, you start the first night and go in one bar and you're drinking all these double martinis and you carry on to another bar and another bar and another bar. But as you say, you pop up at dawn at your advertising agency.
Right, two hours
of napping, but
that's exactly
booze
it.
Oozing out of your pores.
Oh, it was just a hideous feeling, you know, and that's how I spent my 20s. I mean, I never, ever came home before 4:30, which is, you know, in New York, the bars close at 4. And I was out every single night till 4. And, you know, some nights I would sleep 4 hours, and other nights I would just, you know, pass out for an hour and I would go to work. I mean, there were a few horrible times when I would go to work in the same, you know, sort of suit that I'd been in the day before, you know, reeking of cigarette smoke from being in a bar, you know, just reeking of alcohol. And it was really, it took an incredible amount of energy, you know. I mean, I was advertising. It's odd that I even fell into it, and I felt really grateful to be able to do it. I mean, I have no education beyond, like, fourth grade. So I didn't want to lose it, you know. And, I mean, I was lucky that I was as good at it as I was because I was operating on, you know, one quarter of a brain.
Yeah, you're actually, I was just finding the quote. It says, advertising makes everything seem better than it actually is, and that's why it's such a perfect career for me. Can you explain that?
It's true, though. If you think about it, I mean, advertising, you know, there's always a problem. So it's like if you have a client who comes to you and they say, theoretically, you know, we've got this toothpaste and it's really great, except if you brush your teeth 4 times a day with it, we found that it causes oral cancer, you know. I can turn that around and say, well, now just brush once a day. And that's because I was raised by my mother's crazy shrink in this horrible house full of lunatics. And I just learned, you know, I've got to be positive or I'm going to die. I just absolutely had to be sort of maniacally optimistic. And that's what made me successful at advertising. I was always able to find something really good in a product, you know, find sort of a good heart in whatever product or service it was.
It's amazing that you were so successful, though. I mean, we'll look at how you sort of nearly destroyed it in a minute, but, you know, how does a 19-year-old kid who's only had a fourth grade education go around knocking on advertising agencies saying, I'd be just the guy to write your jingles?
It's, you know, it's fortunate. What's the saying? Ignorance is bliss. I didn't know anything about advertising, and actually, I was a waiter at a horrible restaurant, in Northampton, Massachusetts, and a friend persuaded me to go to computer programming school. So I did this. And it was one of those trade schools that you see advertised on daytime television, you know. And one day I was home and I was in the school, I enrolled, and I saw a commercial for the school, and it was so cheesy and embarrassing, and it was like suddenly painfully clear to me that I'm not at Yale or Harvard. And I thought it was the proverbial light bulb, you know, going off of your head. I thought, I could do that. So I sat down and I rewrote all the ads in a magazine, and I called up advertising agencies in Boston, and I said, you know, I want to be in advertising. And the good thing about advertising agencies is that they do not care where you come from. You know, you really could have a crawl space under your kitchen filled with little girls' bones, and as long as you can write a better chuck wagon commercial, you're in. So they saw me. And, you know, unfortunately, I can't spell any word that has more than four letters. So I was sort of told, you know, oh, thanks for coming in. This is horrible. Go away. But one person told me it was a great portfolio, but I did have to learn to spell. So I just basically, he told me actually to go to California. So I did, and I got a job at the first place I interviewed at. And then as soon as I got some success in California, I came right to New York.
Can I ask you, Augustine, you know, do you think that until it got out of hand, the alcohol was an aid to your creativity? A lot of performers argue that, you know, that it sort of, yeah, it fuels the creative juices and takes off the edge, so it kind of removes your nervousness. Did you find that? High-functioning alcoholic?
Yeah, it certainly loosens you up, you know. It's a disinhibitory. It absolutely does do that. You know, it makes you just want to you know, be crazy, and it sort of does get the juices flowing. The problem is the term high-functioning alcoholic is a little misleading, because it almost makes it seem as though there's a certain, you know, species of alcoholic who can remain high-functioning, you know, and alcoholic, and that's actually not true, because eventually it's just the way it works, you know, physiologically it'll take you down. So, but in the beginning, I mean, it was great. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, when I was like 19, 20, 21, you know, who needed sleep? You know, so it was fine that I was out drinking till 4 a.m. It just didn't even seem to matter. And alcohol and advertising go hand in hand, you know, so it wasn't like it was sneered at for drinking. I mean, one of the agencies I worked at here in New York had a huge bar in the cafeteria. So, and all the creatives, which is what they're called, art directors and copywriters, are called creatives, had refrigerators, you know, where they would keep beer. So I think in the beginning it was a great, you know, fun thing. And this culture especially, that's how we relax. You know, we work hard, and then we go out and we have drinks. And, you know, a few of us, unfortunately, do not know how to stop.
So we
just keep drinking.
We spool forward 9 years, and your agency gives you the ultimatum, you will go into rehab.
Right. I thought it was a joke, you know, because I thought I'd been covering myself pretty well. I mean, you know, yeah, I missed a few, you know, meetings and some brainstorming sessions, and I did smell, but, you know, big deal. But unfortunately, it was a big deal because it was affecting my work. So I was told, you have to go to rehab or get out. And the idea of being thrown out of advertising was terrifying, because, I mean, seriously, I don't know the multiplication tables, you know. There's no way I could even work at a store, because I can't make change. So what am I going to do, you know? So I better keep this job. And then I thought about it, and I thought, you know, rehab is not going to be that bad.
It's going to be like... Absolutely. You've got a little reading there. I'd love to bring that in. This is what you thought rehab was going to be like. I think it's on page 37, Augustine, if you're looking for the...
Sure, yeah. I have replayed my internal rehab hospital tourism tapes over and over. My favorite goes like this. A discreet Frank Lloyd Wright-ish compound shrouded mysteriously from public view by a tasteful wall of trimmed boxwood trees. Ian Schrager, of course, created the interior. Spare rooms, sun-drenched with firm mattresses and white 300-count Egyptian cotton sheets. There is a nightstand, probably made of birch, with a galvanized steel top, and on it, chicken soup for the alcoholic soul, and a carafe of ice water with lemon wedges. Nurses will be far too holistic and nurturing to wear white polyester. They will wear, perhaps, tailored hemp smocks, and when they are backlit by one of the many floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the lily pond, I will see the outline of their lean, athletic legs. There will be a large pool. I will forgive its heavy chlorination, because I will understand. This is a hospital, after all. But as the landscape transforms from flatlands to industrial parks, I begin to worry. Nowhere in my vision have I encountered so many parking lots filled with minivans. Where is the lush scenery? The pond with the rare Japanese goldfish? Where are the meandering hiking trails? My internal rehab hospital tourism tape has been snagged inside my internal VCR.
Yeah, Augustine, it wasn't quite the way you envisaged it, was it? No Robert Downey Jr. for a start.
No, I mean, I thought, you know, rehab, I'll be with, like, Drew Barrymore and Robert Downey Jr. and I'll bond. And, like, you know, in 8 months I'll end up over at Gwyneth Paltrow's flat in Malibu. But it was not like that, you know, to my utter and complete horror. It was like a medical school slash hospital, you know. I mean, we definitely had the thin, you know, there were tissue-thin sheets that smelled like bleach and disinfectant, linoleum floor. I mean, it was a hospital, you know. No mistake about that. This was not a spa. And you'd wake up at 6:30, you know, you'd be fed, you know, in like a group feeding pen. And then it would be one class after another, you know, whether it was like a confrontational group therapy or a class about, you know, chemical dependency where you quantify what you've actually been drinking your whole life, you know, a whole number of classes.
You know, the thing I found curious, really, is I was sort of reading it and thinking, oh, this is terrible. This is like English public school, right down to the food, you know, the tapioca dinners and the shepherd's pie and fish burger sandwiches and everything.
Right.
And I thought, hang on, this guy's supposed to be drying out. It must be painful. It must be agony. Were you putting the gloss on it, you know, expunging the nasty bits and sort of concentrating on the things that might resonate with us? I mean, were you editing the tough stuff out?
No, I'm only like positive and funny, you know, in retrospect. I mean, at the time I was writing in my journal, I brought a journal with me and I was just horrified by it. I mean, I was literally ready to check out every hour, you know, the AA phrase, one day at a time. I was getting through rehab literally 1 hour at a time. And I did not see the humor in the situation at all. And it took a few days for it to finally sort of click. And once it clicked, I realized, you know, I definitely need to be here. There was one person I met there who was from the UK, and Hayden, and he loved the food, by the way. He was just could not have been happier with the little fish cake sandwiches and all the mashy things.
You made a mistake there, though, you know. You said
I know,
he loved the food because they'd have that stuff like Vegemite. It's Marmite in
right.
England. And as an
exactly.
ad man, you should know,
Marmite.
It's Marmite, my mate, Marmite.
I know.
It's one of the worst ad ads I've ever heard of. But anyway, yeah, sorry, to carry on. I mean, you had this kind of way of being involved in it, but kind of being detached.
Well, I've always, I've definitely always had that quality of being detached, you know. I once had a therapist tell me that I had the ability to sort of step back and see my life as though it's a play or a movie, which she actually thought was a good thing. But again, when I was all through rehab, I was definitely, you know, sort of there was a part of me that was removed. And I don't know if that's something that is a quality that writers have in common, you know, or if it's something, again, that I learned in my childhood because of the way I was raised. But I was detached to a degree. And, you know, that's another alcoholic thing, is alcoholics have no idea what they're ever feeling. You know, I had to carry around this, they gave us these little charts. This sounds so ridiculous, but it's true. And they had little faces, happy, sad. And I had to look at it to know what I was feeling.
Augustine Burroughs, thanks for the moment. We're talking about AA rehab and the road to recover with our author, the author of Dry Connection. Listeners, can we kick our habits by reinventing our inner and our outer worlds? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-823-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking about dealing with our addictions by reinventing ourselves. My guest is Augustine Burroughs, author of the new wickedly funny memoir, Dry, about his struggle with alcohol. Connection listeners, can too much humor be an obstacle for a healthy recovery? Or is it the answer? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Augustine Burroughs, I think, you know, in that first segment, you left more questions than answers. First of all, just remind us how you got to be where you are. You know, what we read about in your first book, Running with Scissors, your mother abandoning you, handing you to the psychiatrist when you were 30.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the little quick CV of your really rotten childhood.
Okay, well, the real quick version is, you know, Mike Nichols' film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, with Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. That was basically my childhood. My parents hated each other. My mother wanted to be a famous poet along the lines of, like, Anne Sexton. And she was very ambitious, and she spent all her time writing. And she was also mentally ill. And so to save the marriage, my parents sought the help of this psychiatrist. And it didn't work. You know, he didn't save the marriage. And my mother continued to see the psychiatrist. Now, the doctor, Dr. Finch, looked just exactly like Santa Claus. You know, he was this sort of big, short, jolly guy with white hair and big toothbrush bristle eyebrows, you know, and he talked like this. And he was very, very eccentric. And my mother began seeing him, you know, and once, twice a week, and then three, four times a week, and then every single day for 3 hours a day.
And then she dumped you with him.
And then she dumped me with him. She, you know, couldn't raise me. She just did. She was just too unstable, and she needed her time to write. So I lived with the doctor in his crazy, dilapidated Victorian house in Western Massachusetts. Now, the doctor had always wanted to have his own private mental hospital, but he was never actually given that authority. So he sort of created his own at his house using, you know, his family members. He had a very large family and a few patients. You know,
yeah,
there was an
obsessive-compulsive...
you're
a 13-year-old boy, and you've got another man in the house who's a pedophile.
Well, there was another guy. He lived in the barn behind the house, and he was about 33, and he became my sort of special friend. And my mother, actually, and the doctor approved of our, well, I used the term relationship loosely, of our relationship. And the doctor believed when you were 13, you were an adult and free to make all your own decisions, you know. So that's why there was no school, because if you ask a 13-year-old, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to school or sit home and watch TV? You know, school's not going to be happening. So I didn't go to school. And I hooked up with the pedophile, who was his adopted son, which is a euphemism for patient.
Now,
so that's my childhood. You know, big surprise, I became an alcoholic right after that.
Yeah, you've catalogued it. That was what you had to do when you went into rehab, is catalogue your abuse. And it starts as a child, doesn't it? You've got reading about that.
I do. They made us sort of write down on a marker board all of our drinking. So I wrote, age 7. Given NyQuil for cold. Grandfather is NyQuil salesman, so we have cases of it. Green is favorite color, so sometimes sneak sips. Age 12, first real drunk. One bottle of red wine, threw up on friend's sheepdog. Ages 13 through 17, smoke pot once a week, drink alcohol maybe once a week. Age 18, drink nightly, always to intoxication. 5 drinks per night, plus or minus. Ages 19 through 20, drink maybe 10 drinks per night with occasional binges, coke once every 6 months. Ages 21 to present, a liter of Dewar's scotch a night, often chased with cocktails, cocaine once a month. I stand back and look, a jumble of blue words, my messy writing, my magic marker, confession up here for all to see. I've never actually quantified before. And that's when it really hit me in rehab that this is, you know, not... The group... therapy person, the counselor said, when you look at that on the board up there, what you just written, what do you think? And my reaction was, you know, well, now that I see it, it does seem like I kind of drink a lot, you know? And it, you know, other patients in the room were looking at me with, you know, sort of wide eyes, like, are you crazy? I mean, that's a lot of alcohol. And that's when it really hit me that, okay, the average person doesn't drink as much. But what really, really crystallized it for me was when I then sort of said to the person, you know, does Benadryl count, the antihistamine? And she said, well, what do you mean, you know? And the fact is, I had to take about 10 Benadryl every time I drank 10 of these, you know, because if I didn't, I would get this allergic reaction and I couldn't breathe and I'd get hives. So I had this actual allergy, you know, to alcohol that I had to, that required antihistamines in order for me to drink. And a normal person would think, okay, well, then I can't drink, you know? And I would, of course, think, well, I'll just take 50 Benadryls if I have to. So that's the alcoholic mind for you.
You know, the thing about your book is, on one level it says, you know, pain equals abuse and the way to cure yourself is you really have to sort of face up to your pain. Where does the humor fit into the equation, though?
I think that humor is, it's something I've always had a sense of humor about my situation. I've always been able to not take myself so dreadfully, dreadfully seriously. I mean, I looked at my mother, you know, as a child, and my mother was a victim in life, you know, and she was pretty humorless. And it just didn't work, you know. I mean, that's kind of self-pity and that kind of you know, oh, my life's been so awful and I am owed so much, did not advance her in life. And I was always able to see the sort of ridiculousness of whatever situation I was in. And, you know, maybe it's also a defense mechanism. I mean, when things are so terrible, you know, I always kind of step back and I do find the humor in the situation. And it's useful to a point. I mean, it's true that you definitely have to do some serious work. You know, that's when you pay your $100 an hour for your therapist and sit on the couch and, you know, grab the tissues every 2 minutes. And that's important to do so that you don't replicate, you know, the same bad behavior over and over. But you also can't just take yourself so seriously, because so much of what is terrible is funny.
Augustin, lots of people want to talk to you. 1-800-433-8255 to hook up with Augustin Burroughs. Lon, calling from Raleigh in North Carolina. Lon, what's your point?
Hi, I wanted to say that laughter is extremely important to one's sanity. I am committed to having one bout of hysterical laughter every day, not at anyone's expense, but it has kept me healthy and happy for these 45 years. I was in an abusive marriage many years ago. I'm a single parent of three wonderful children, and the reason they're wonderful is because we were, like, hysterical every day, and that's a healthy way to go through life. And I also find it very depressing and boring to be around people who are always crying.
Yeah,
so
that's
true.
Point.
I totally agree.
But Lon, don't you have to dump the abusive husband before you can have a good laugh about it?
Oh, I still laugh about him, too, at my mother's house. Well, I was like, okay, he's crazy, Ma. I'll be over at your house sooner or later. I mean, yeah, I had to have laughter with him. And, yes, I did dump him. I told my friends, hey, you know, I lost 180 pounds this year. And they were like, what? I said, yeah, I kicked my husband out. So I totally
that's
believe
great.
In the humor. It's essential to surviving.
It is. It totally is. You're right.
Augustin, does the pain help the humor in a way?
Well, I think the pain probably is the root of the humor. I wish I had a PhD in humor or pain. I could tell you, you know, I'm sure that what's the phrase, you know, truth is the root of all humor, you know, and pain is the root of all humor. So I think that's probably true.
And is pain a really good way to get material? I mean, you mentioned that several times in your book, didn't you? It's going to be great material, going to rehab,
yeah.
Going to AA.
I did, you know, I did think that, and I have, you know, turned, I mean, I've had some kind of horribly painful things happen to me, and then I've found the humor in them later, you know, later, much later, you know, it tends to not be hilarious actually when it's happening.
Well, I love this lovely little piece. Well, there are two, actually, beautiful pieces. One of this mm-hmm. was about your AA meetings, and you said meetings are the Hail Marys of alcoholics. You can do almost do
it's
anything,
true, though,
feel
right?
anything, commit anything. And you have this little imaginary conversation. After I cut off his penis, I sauteed it in rosemary butter and I ate it. Question, but did you go to a meeting afterwards? Yes, and I wouldn't worry about it then. I mean, that idea of an AA meeting, did you think that at the time?
I did. It seemed like permission because, you know, you go to AA and a lot of people are there and they're, you know, well, I had 14 years, but I picked up last night, you know, and I killed my dog accidentally today, whatever. And as long as you're a meeting, it's okay, you know, it's okay. So there's definitely that sense that, you know, ooh, it's very permissive. You can, you know, you can do everything you want to here as long as you attend a meeting the next day.
Totally different issue, but something that was totally absurd. Just tell us a story about the minibar. Didn't you get charged $10,000?
That was horrifying.
That was amazing.
I was, after I got out, I was sober, and I had a commercial production in Los Angeles, and we were at a swanky hotel. And I'm not drinking at this point, you know. So I get on the, you know, do the shoot, and I'm back on the plane. Commercial production's over. I'm going over my expense report, and I've got this, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in minibar charges. And I'm like, what? This is impossible. And my partner, my art director partner, said to me, what did you do? Did you just, like, open the minibar and take the little bottles out constantly? Didn't you know these are electronic minibars, and it charges you each time you remove a bottle? I mean, what did you do? Just sit there and put bottles, you know, take them in and out and in and out and in and out the whole time, you know? And that's exactly what I actually did.
Take them out and
I would open the minibar
and
I'd take out
them.
The scotch and put it back and take, yeah, look at it. Hold it up to the light, you know, and look at the pretty amber bottle and then put it back and I was charged. And I talk about how that is so unfair. It's like, you know, paying a lot for a hooker and not even getting a handshake.
Let's take a call from George, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, George.
Hello.
Hey. Hi, George.
How you doing? When my best friend was an active alcoholic, the thing that helped me the most was a book by Ann Wilson Schaaf called When Society Becomes an Addict. And since reading that book, I've looked around and I've said, gee, you know, this really is true. Society has a lot of addictive characteristics. And as an advertising man or an ex-advertising man, you were somebody who is involved with creating wants and desires and feeding into some of those addictions, which are not necessarily alcohol. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the social structure and the addictive responses you see in society or in advertising.
I think that's a good point, you know, and it's so true in terms of this culture being addictive, and advertising plays right into that because it is all about making people want things, you know, and maybe even more than want them, need them, you know, need. And I think that so many of us walk around in our lives filled with profound need. I mean, what do we need? We need either food or we need to be loved, and we need to be loved more than we can be loved, and we need, you know. And it's just, it's incredible when you think about the things people can get addicted to. I mean, alcohol is one thing, you know, but all addictions are really, really similar when you think about it, whether it's drugs or sex or food. You know, it doesn't matter how much you drink to be an alcoholic, it's your relationship with it. I mean, if you have two drinks a night, but they are all you can think about during the day and you can think about nothing else, then, you know, well, you're an alcoholic. And it's the same thing with people's relationships with food and with sex and shopping, you know, and television watching. We are a consuming culture. You know, we have a voracious appetite for more. And I wish I could tell you, how do we become, you know, perfect and spiritual and calm and, you know, meditate on our little grass mats and make hummus from scratch? I don't know how to do that. But advertising definitely feeds into that, and it magnifies that, you know. Bad people are part of the culture, though, just as much as anybody else.
George, do you think we're all addicts? Hi, George.
Yeah. I think that what you have to keep on running the steps, and maybe step one is the first thing that you have to do over and over again. I think that we have a culture and a political attitude right now, especially that feeds into addiction for oil, addiction for power, a feeling of crisis, a feeling of fear. And to be honest, from everything that I've read, we also have a president who has had problems with alcohol and has not admitted or gone to seek therapy for this kind of stuff. He's just gone to God. And I don't think he's thought through the process, and I don't think we as a culture have thought through the process, or as individuals.
When you talk about step one, you mean, my name's George, and I'm a, well, not an alcoholic, but an addict to whatever.
I realize that I don't have power over whatever my addiction is, but the addiction has power over me.
George, thanks very much. Augustine, interesting point that came out in your rehab is when they identify the addict in you as almost another being, and this addict is making demands on you which are totally incompatible with you, like isolating you for a start in this horrific house, flat.
Right. It's like you are being held hostage by some sort of terrorist. I mean, I wanted a quote-unquote normal life, you know, with a healthy relationship where I was out, you know, doing normal things, seeing movies and plays and making dinner. And yet I was being held prisoner, you know, in my own apartment, you know, and there was this force driving me to just let the bottles collect, let it become a mess so I can never invite anybody over, you know.
So that you could go back home alone and actually get smashed.
Go back home alone. Yeah, exactly. You know, and there'd be a day where I would think, you know, I'm not going to drink tonight. And then there'd be a little voice. I mean, it was, you know, really a little thing that said, you know what, why not? You know, you're so bad already. Just go ahead and drink. And it really was like having a being, you know, inside you. And I think that really is what the caller was talking about in terms of the first step, realizing that you don't have control over this thing. You know, it's something that, you know, you can't stop. You know, you've got to obey it. It's very sort of a Stepford moment. You've got to do what the voice says, you know, the drinking. And but it is. It's like having a little monster inside you that you need to exercise, you know, and take out.
Is
I talk...
Is that where George really hit the nail on the head there, when he was talking about the lack of personal responsibility, and too many of us, if not all of us, are like that? It's someone else's fault.
I think we are like that as a culture, but I don't necessarily think it's catastrophic. I mean, I think there are degrees, you know, so much of it is in the gray area. You know, yeah, we're probably an addictive culture, but that has good things, you know, there are good qualities, good points to being that sort of addictive. We're perfectionists, you know, we strive hard, we work hard, we have a lot of pride in what we do, you know, and anything is possible in this culture. So, you know, we're definitely, you know, consumptive and addictive, and, you know, we got to watch it. But there are also terrific strengths within those same qualities.
Someone like you would have. I mean, if you're looking for excuses for being an addict, you know, you've got plenty there.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you must be the ultimate one of being able to, you know, if you wanted to wield out of the personal responsibility, you could. How do you get around that?
I could just whine, right? I've just never been the kind of person to believe that I was owed anything. That's not to say I didn't want things, you know, but I never felt that it was owed to me or that it was someone else's fault, you know, that I didn't get what I wanted. I just really believe that if you want something, you have to be the one to get it, and that ultimately you're responsible for your own happiness. And that, to me, has been proven again and again. It's nice to think that, you know, someone will take care of you, or that, you know, the universe, you know, will take care of you, or that you are owed something. But in the end, really, you're the person who makes it happen.
But you do need your friends.
Well, you need your friends, absolutely. But that's part of making something happen. I mean, you choose your friends. You know, you choose people who are supportive and who are compassionate, you know, and who are emotionally substantial. And these are all things you can do, you know, to be successful in your life.
And your friends are quite an important part of the book. We'll get to that after the break. We're having a conversation about laughter on the road to sobriety with our guest today, Augustine Burroughs, the author of Dry. Connection listeners, our guest is taking your calls. We'd like to hear what you think. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. This hour we're talking with author Augustine Burroughs. His new memoir, Dry, recounts his battle with alcoholism and the funny side of recovery. Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Augustine Burroughs, we were talking about, well, we just alluded to friends before the break. Mm-hmm. Is it simplistic in your book to say this pighead who was sort of the love of your life, the friend of your life, he dies of AIDS? Foster is the new love who's a self-destructive crackhead, and he's the bad influence. Is it so simplistic to say Pighead, good influence, Foster, bad influence, and the fact that you didn't recognize your relationship with Pighead was why things maybe went more wrong than they should have done?
Well, it is simplistic, but then again, so am I.
but so am I.
A slug, almost like something that lives on the very bottom of the sea. That is pretty accurate, you know, and Pighead I absolutely loved and could not face what was happening there. With his, he was, you know, very, very sick, and he was dying, you know, and I would not allow myself to believe that or see that. And I just could not be, one of the popular words to use in self-help is present for that. So I could not be present for him. And then there was Foster. You know, one of the things when I got out of rehab, I went to group therapy, and I had to sign this little slip of paper that said, I promise not to become romantically involved with anyone from group. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, how hard is that? Who wants to get involved with sympathetic, you know, alcoholic loser from group therapy? And, of course, that's exactly what happened. I became besotted with this crack addict. And, you know, that's one of the things in recovery they suggest is not to become romantically involved for a year And that's really good advice because you really are looking for something to put your focus on. Anything except yourself and the fact that you can't drink and you need to go to, you know, AA meetings. So you're always looking for, you know, what can I do? What distracting? You know, you want to fill your supermarket cart with all, you run down the aisles filling the cart with everything you can, meats and chutneys and, you know, chicken parts. And that's what it's kind of like, you know. So when you get romantically involved with someone, A, you tend to find people who are, you know, going to be a lot of work, you know, not necessarily the healthiest people for you. And B, they're going to be all you think about. So while my friend Pighead, who was my sort of rock, my very stable friendship and, you know, the person I was really in love with, while he was sick and needed me, that was just too serious. You know, that would have required more of me, more substance and more courage, more guts than I was willing to or was capable of giving, you know. So hey, let's hang out with the crack addict mess.
Last people to talk to you, 1-843-8255. John calling from St. George, South Carolina. John, what do you want to say to Augustine?
I just want to. Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. I just wanted to congratulate him. I have referred my little story to the previous person that works for you. I'm 73 years old, and this past July 23rd, I've been sober 31 years. And
wow.
I know what your guess is probably what he's went through. I had to go through rehab. After I got sobered up, I even went on to college and got my degree and started working in the substance abuse counseling area. I worked with crackheads. I worked with cocaine users that use the pot. I work with all substance abuse.
Okay, John, you're a startling success story. Sober 31 years. What's the secret?
It's like I had told a previous person. I said it's something that you must want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it for your mom, pop, children, or nobody. It's something that you must want to do for yourself. And if you don't do it for that reason, it's not going to last. I've seen some folks that have been sober 4 and 5 years, and they come to the AA meetings crying. They're kind of sneaking around the corner, getting them a little drink here and there until they caught up with them again.
John, thanks very much for your call. 1-800-438-2255. Doug is joining us from Toronto in Canada. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. But questions physiologically. I think I'm on the cusp of this at about age 57. Of being an addictive kind of personality too, and during the dry out period, I'm now discovering that whether it's neurological or whatever, if I go on a little binge, I come back and it takes me 3-4 weeks almost to get rid of the shakes. Is that common?
Yeah, I think that probably is common. It's progressive, you know, alcoholism, and it gets worse the more you drink. So I know that when I was at the very tail end of my alcoholism, it was really difficult for me to stop shaking. You know, I mean, I was sort of seeing the spiders on the ceiling. And when you're shaking, when you've reached a point when you are shaking without the alcohol, that's pretty serious. That's something you want to really look at.
Doug, I don't think Augustine's not really a doctor. He's more about strategy, I think, and coping. What are you using to cope, Doug?
Probably alcohol.
Yeah, well, I know. You know, it's
easy,
comforting,
right?
For a while, right?
Huh?
It's totally. Yeah. The thing about alcohol is that eventually, you know, it won't give you the same comfort. You'll lose the ability to get that buzz and that escape, and it'll let you down. And that's really the problem. It lets you down emotionally, you know, because it does not keep working. And, I mean, I'm just a lot happier now that I'm not drinking. That's what I can tell you. It's a night and day. And you don't have to ever do it alone. That's the great thing. And that's probably why, to me, AA works, or a lot of these things can work, is it's other people. You know, this is not something you should be doing alone, you know. There are millions of other people who are exactly like you. I mean, I get email every single day from leading political figures in this country to movie stars, to famous singers, to doctors, to lawyers, to homemakers, to soccer moms, to stay-at-home dads, exactly saying the same thing you're saying, you know. So it's not like anything you should ever be ashamed. If anything, you should be proud of it.
Doug, thank you, Cole. Let's bring in John from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just wondering, what do you do when you're basically a positive person, but all of a sudden you have found yourself surrounded by negative and fatalistic type people in your life?
Avoid them. No, I know that's tough. It's tough. And that is one of those things where, you know, you need to really find out, is that going to be the way they, you know, they are? If you may need to do some housekeeping, you know, and reevaluate your friendships, because it's important not to surround yourself with negative people who are, in fact, going to bring you down. You need to really surround yourself with people who are positive and who are innately positive, who have a healthy attitude in life. So, you know, you probably should think about meeting even more people that share your values and your beliefs.
Augustine, you talk about reinventing yourself, and obviously mm-hmm. you have. I mean, you've reinvented
quite
yourself
a few times.
As a reinvented yourself as an author. Is there a process? You changed your name for a start.
Yeah, when I was 18, I changed my name. I decided, you know, I was so embarrassed of what happened to me as a child, of my childhood. I just decided it didn't happen. You know, it did not happen. So I changed my first, middle, and last name, and I became, you know, Augustine Burroughs, you know, ad guy. And I think one of your previous callers, I think his name was John, talked about, in a, you know, to be sober, you have to want it, you know, more than anything. And that's true. And that's true with anything I found in life, is when I wanted to get into advertising, it didn't matter that I had a fourth grade education and couldn't spell. I decided I was going to do it. And that was absolutely the end of the discussion in my head. It was going to happen. And I've been able to do that in my life a few times. When I was at the very end of my drinking, I realized I'm going to die. I am drinking to the point where I'm going to get alcohol poisoning for good and die and have a heart attack. And I decided I'm going to try to become a successful writer. You know, this is what I've always wanted to do. I'm going to make it happen, you know. And it's been, my life has been a series of reinventions. I mean, it's odd. When I think back to my childhood, I mean, I feel like such an old haggard thing. I feel like I'm ready for assisted living, to be honest with you. I really do. I feel like I'm well into my hundreds. I mean, I can't believe that even like 5 years ago seems different. When I think about how it was not that long ago when I was like living in squalor as a crazy alcoholic, it really was not that long ago.
Well,
and now I feel like it's completely different.
Do you think the alcohol helped? Or being an alcoholic, you talked about that absolute squalor. I mean, we described the state of you.
I don't regret any of it.
We described the state of you when you were the ad man at the beginning mm-hmm. of the book. I mean, when you had your relapse, that was just unbelievable. You know, lying on
hideous.
A urine-soaked mattress and mm-hmm. hives all over you.
There's nothing glamorous. Sorry?
No, carry on.
There was nothing glamorous about any of it. And, I mean, I don't want to do it again, but I don't regret any of it, you know? I do not regret a single day of it. And I guess maybe that's because I'm some sort of experience junkie. Great things happened to me when I was drinking, you know? Some great things happened that would not have happened otherwise. And, you know, it's like so much in life, it's not black or white. You know, there are wonderful qualities and things about being an alcoholic. You know, it is comforting. And it is always there, you know, until it's not, until it stops working for you physiologically. And it's something, you know, you can do. It's something to do. It's like a hobby. It's like crochet or macrame pot holders, you know. It's definitely a hobby. So it's not a black and white thing. I mean, there are definitely things about being a big alcoholic mess that I enjoyed. But overall, you know, if it comes down to a checklist, you know, columns, spreadsheet column, I'm a lot happier sober.
I was wondering, though, the point I was trying to get to is if you're trying to reinvent yourself, mm-hmm. if scraping rock bottom in a way helps, because if you're somebody who just has a fourth grade education and, you know, you think I'd like to be a writer and you think, oh, come on, I've got a fourth grade education, I can't do that. But if you hit rock bottom, what have you got to lose?
That's you are exactly right. That's exactly what it is.
How unusual.
Have you got to lose? You know?
Yeah.
But that's true. You know, what have you, and that's what I kind of felt like is, you know, I'm almost dead anyway. So why not try? You know, like I'm going to fail, like I'm going to let anybody down, you know, like I'm going to embarrass myself. I mean, give me a break. I'm sleeping in a bed, you know, that I haven't washed the sheets for months and months and months, and their urine soaked, like you said. This is not a lot to lose, you know? So, and it's also, I think I've got this ability, as many alcoholics do, to be in denial. So I can think about, I don't think about how difficult it is to become a writer or the odds of getting published or the odds of anybody liking anything. That to me conveniently doesn't exist.
Let's bring in Jeremy. So, one last call. Jeremy from Greensboro, North Carolina wants to have a word. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to thank the author for everything he's doing. You know, I'm in recovery myself. I'm 27. Most of the people I know, you know, they're still out there drinking and using, and I find it, you know, real difficult to get in touch with them. You know, I can see they got problems and everything.
Has the book helped you? Have you read the book, Jeremy?
No, I'm going to read it, though. I'm going to read it.
There you go. Jeremy from Greensboro, thanks very much indeed. Augustine, one thing, the practicalities. You talk about, you know, there are good times in alcohol, there's good times with drink, that it is almost like a friend. It must be like losing a friend and also filling up a lot of time.
Yeah, I did not know what to do with myself when I got out of rehab. I mean, they say, go to a meeting, go to an AA meeting, but that's an hour and a half. What do you do for those other fat, shiny, empty 24 hours in a day? So I hadn't realized how much of my life and my time was occupied with drinking. I mean, it was so much to me. It was just so many hours of my life. And it was like, it was absolutely like losing a friend or a lover. You know, it was very much like losing a lover. Someone that you cared. I mean, you do. I cared more about alcohol than I did care about any flesh and blood human being in my life. So it was you go through a grieving process. The realization that I can't drink again. This is it. I cannot have another drink again is you just want to weep. And it also feels impossible. And then you know, well, I can relapse. Maybe I can relapse. And then you relapse and it's just worse than you ever imagined. And you realize, you know, I can't get away with this anymore. You know, if I relapse again, I'm going to end up dead. And it is. You have to come to terms with the fact that it's like losing someone you love so, so, so much.
Does anything replace it? Does something like writing become your new addiction?
There you go. Writing became my new addiction, you know, and writing is absolutely what I spend all my time, all my drinking time on. You know, it's my constructive hobby. You need to replace it with something. You know, you can't just take something away. You've got to fill it with something. So, you know, you should either adopt 7 dogs or, you know, start working in a hospital, taking care of people who need it. Something to get yourself outside yourself.
Augustine, thanks so much for joining us. Our guest today, Burroughs, author of Dry, a memoir of a recovering alcoholic. To continue the conversation and to learn more about our guest, you can visit our website, www.theconnection.com. Connections produced by Khalil Bird, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Koritsky Fox, Jen Matson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.